The event also invited ambassadors to Iran, who took part to congratulate Iranians on the occasion.
We have a very long history of relationship with Iran, 119 years. Next year, we will be celebrating 120 years of diplomatic relations between our countries. So our relations have always been very good, sometimes closer, sometimes not so close. But in the last years, we have had very good relations, trade relations, political relations.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. Iranian officials say independence is one of the accomplishments brought about by the Islamic Republic in Iran.
43 years have passed since the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and well-wishers are trying to deal a blow to the establishment, but because we are an independent country in every sense of the world, enemies have not been able to harm our nation using sanctions and pressures.
Since its establishment, the Islamic Republic has faced many challenges, from the Western-funded Iraqi war to the stringent sanctions imposed against the country by the U.S. and Europe. Authorities of the Islamic Republic say the establishment has reached maturity in its fourth decade of life and will not surrender to Western pressures. The Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, and later was replaced by God's name, Allah, in the center, a reflection of the Iranians' Islamic beliefs, which they say were not addressed during the Shah era. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In the limelight. Former Tory cabinet minister David Davis said on Saturday, 2nd of April, that if the Conservatives were to become known as the party of high taxes, the damage to their economic reputation would be as deep and lasting as that inflicted on John Major's government by the disaster of Black Wednesday in September of 1992. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Toby Helm, Shanti Das and Philip Inman. The piece is titled Tory Spear Poll Disaster Over High Taxes. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, is facing a growing Tory revolt over economic policy and its handling of the cost of living crisis, as senior Conservatives warn that high taxes will fatally undermine their party's appeal to voters at the next general election. Former Tory Cabinet Minister David Davis said on Saturday, 2nd of April, that if the Conservatives were to become known as the party of high taxes, the damage to their economic reputation would be as deep and lasting as that inflicted on John Major's government by the disaster of Black Wednesday in September of 1992. David Davis told The Observer that with the country now operating with the highest overall tax burden for decades, the electoral dangers were clear. David Davis added, acquiring a reputation for being at the high tax party will do every bit as much damage to the Conservative Party as the ERM crisis did to us in the 1990s. Britain's chaotic and costly exit from the European Union's exchange rate mechanism scarred the Major government's reputation for economic management and put it on course for the crushing defeat by New Labour in 1997. Recently, an opinion poll for the Labour List website caused deep concern among Tory MPs as it found the Conservatives were already seen as the party of high taxation by more voters, about 39%, than had that view of Labour, 27%. Asked which they regarded as the party of low taxation, 30% named Labour and 27% cited the Tories in the Savanta Comrades survey. Even after offering some limited tax reductions in last month's spring statement, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak tried to ease the effects of the cost of living crisis. The overall burden of taxation in the UK is still at its highest since the 1950s, when the country was rebuilding after the Second World War. Rishi Sunak, who is reportedly heading to California for a holiday over Easter, used his spring statement to cut fuel duty by 5p a litre, and announced that the threshold at which people start paying national insurance would rise from £9,568 to £12,750 in July. However, when insisting he was wedded to low taxes, he decided to hold back most of an estimated £20 billion war chest received from extra tax receipts resulting from inflation for pre-election tax cuts. In a highly unusual move, he promised a reduction in the basic rate of income tax from 20p to 19p, but not until 2024. Many Conservative MPs believe he should bring forward tax cuts now in order to boost growth, and that it will be too late to pose as a tax-cutting chancellor in 2024. Others have criticised Rishi Sunak for failing to do enough to support low earners and those on benefits. On Saturday, 2nd of April, as protests about the cost of living were held across the country, former Conservative leader Ian Duncan Smith said that rather than keeping taxes high to control the deficit, Rishi Sunak should stimulate economic growth by lowering them and at the same time offer more help to people on universal credit by increasing the amount they can earn before their benefits are reduced. Warning against keeping taxes high and the risk of stagflation, low growth plus rising inflation, Ian Duncan Smith said, "Fiscal squeezing is a disaster at this time and we shouldn't do it. Cutting the deficit will actually add to the problem of stagflation." The veteran Conservative MP Peter Bone said the Chancellor had to act now to cut taxes or risk a repeat of the 1990s when voters formed a fixed opinion of a lack of Tory economic competence that proved impossible to shift before the 1997 general election. Veteran Tory MP Peter Bone noted, "John Major got the economy back on track after the ERM debacle, but the electorate had made up its mind well before that and thought we will give the other guys a chance. We have still got time to get this right, but we need to do this now. We need to correct course now." New analysis by the Resolution Foundation of tax measures taken by Rishi Sunak finds that they will raise £14 billion over the course of the financial year. Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury Pat McFadden said, "The Tories have become the party of high taxation because they're the party of low economic growth. The Tory government is alone among G7 countries in increasing taxes on income this year. The Labour Party is proposing a targeted windfall tax on the profits of North Sea oil and gas companies to help families with their energy bills, and has consistently opposed Rishi Sunak's rise in national insurance contributions. There is also pressure from elsewhere for private companies to offer help. A study of payments to shareholders made by the Big Six energy suppliers shows dividends and share buybacks amounted to £43.5 billion over the past decade." The think tank Commonwealth, which carried out the new research, said the suppliers, Centrica, EDF, E.ON and its subsidiary N-Power, Scottish Power and Scottish and Southern, were in a healthy financial position and could afford to offset some of the soaring cost of electricity and gas faced by their customers. Meanwhile, increasing pressure is being felt by food banks as people struggle to make ends meet and resort to increasingly desperate measures to keep warm and feed their families. Gerard Woodhouse, a local Labour councillor who runs the L6 Community Centre in Everton, Liverpool, said the food bank and food union that the charity runs were opening 6 days a week rather than 4 days due to increased demand, but at the same time had seen a reduction in donations in recent days because people who used to donate now need help themselves. He said, "Shops are donating potatoes, leeks, cabbages, but I can't get rid of them. They're getting handed back to me because people are saying it costs too much to cook." In other cases, he said, people are getting into bed at 6 p.m, so they haven't got to put the heating on or use any electricity. The number of people asking for thicker quilts is crazy. If I had 200 this week, they would have all gone. You hear about the poor times in the 1930s. Those stories are now happening today. It's just going to get worse and worse.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters and dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, and we are looking at the letter written by the commander of the faithful himself to his commander Malik al-Ashtar, which contains the pinnacle and the peak of a human rights that anyone should seek. Amongst the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen commands and tells his commander to do is when it comes to trades and industries, which is an extremely vital part of any system or any government, because this is something that me and you require for our survival. So he says to him, you are advised to treat well businessmen and artisans, and direct others to do likewise. A very short line from Amir al-Mu'mineen, but yet very powerful. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, in this line, he's saying, you're going to have, or you already have businessmen and artists, but what you need to do is take care of them, treat them well, and direct others to do the same, which means you need to encourage people to become entrepreneurs. You need to encourage people to become businessmen. You need to encourage people to become tradesmen, meaning provide means of jobs for people. That is a job of the state. Now, wouldn't be that wonderful if every state that we have in this world and every system and every country tried to apply that simple line of Amir al-Mu'mineen, where they try to provide work and create business opportunities for people, so these communities couldn't thrive, so we could eliminate poverty, so we could eliminate ignorance, we can eliminate all these evil acts that happens. People only commit crimes because of ignorance or because of need. Now, if the businesses are opened and opportunities are available, then this should not happen. So even from that aspect, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, it is the right of people that the state should provide them the means. Now, in a lot of countries, in order for you, sometimes you do have an opportunity to start a business. You do have a plan in mind. You know what to do, okay? And you thought of something that will give you profits. But then trying to put it into practice is where the problem comes into play. You try to get a license, and the government makes it hell for you to get a license or to get a card. You try to get a permit, and the government makes it extremely hard for you to get a permit. You want to import or transport, and they will make it extremely hard for you to bring anything into the country or take anything out of the country. They make it so hard for the common people to do businesses and trades. And why is that? Is it because they don't want you to? Or is it because they don't have the capacity? Or where the problem is? The problem is simple. They have their own businessmen who gives them revenue, so they have agreed with them that only them and them alone will be doing the trades, and they will make sure, they will make it hard for anyone to become competitors with them. So the government is winning, those businessmen who work with them are winning, and the rest of the people, me and you, are suffering. Let us take a short break, and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So Amir al-Mu'mineen advises his commander Malik to take care and treat well businessmen and create business opportunities for the common people. When he talks about artists, and he says some of those artists live in towns, and some move from one place to another. And also businessmen and trades, they do the same thing. With their ware and tools and earn their living by manual labor. Now, when we say an artist, we don't mean a painter or a person who draws. No, an artist is a musician, is an artist. A carpenter is an artist. A blacksmith is an artist. So these guys create art in many forms in throughout their labor. Some of those people, they move from one city to another looking for job opportunities to create their art. For example, even sculpturing, you know, especially back in the day when it comes to houses and creating designs and all these marvels when it comes to, in terms of statues and in terms of creating all this artwork on the walls. It was a thriving business back in the day. So those artists, they move from one place to another with their labor. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he says to Malik, those people need to be taken into consideration. They need to be treated well. And people need to be also pushed to go towards that direction. Which means we are trying to eliminate unemployment as much as we can. Because one of the things that the countries are suffering from today is the high rate of unemployment. And we have a high rate of unemployment is because the government are not creating, and the governments, I should say, are not creating enough job opportunities or business opportunities for people to work. If we open job opportunities for people and create, for example, centers for them to learn the arts, those people themselves, once they become employed and they create a business, they will hire many people and so on and so forth. So that will actually help the nation thrive rather than go backwards. So the Imam says to him, they are those people, businessmen or artists, are the real source of profit to the state and provider of consumer goods. At the end of the day, those businessmen or artists are those who create, are those who, you know, create art for us in different forms that we need. And even, let's say, IKEA, for example, is also a form of art when it comes to the furniture. At the end of the day, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, they not only benefit the state by giving them taxes, but also they provide consumer goods that I and you, at the end of the day, I'm going to need a house, I'm going to need a furniture, I'm going to need a car, I'm going to need utensils, I'm going to need, you know, kitchenware, I'm going to need a lot of things. And these things requires people who sits and design, people who create, people who make, people who manufacture. So they are all required. In this way, poverty gets eliminated. Justice is applied. Society thrives. Human rights, as we can see it, will be protected and people will live a happy life just by looking at one side of the coin. We'll leave it here and we will continue in other episodes until then. Stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
New accounts show that former President Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in plans developed by outside advisors to use national security agencies to seek evidence of fraud. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Maggie Haberman, Michael Schmidt, and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Trump Had Role in Weighing Proposals to Seize Voting Machines. Six weeks after Election Day, with his hold on power slipping, President Donald J. Trump directed his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, to make a remarkable call. Donald Trump wanted him to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states, three people familiar with the matter said. Rudy Giuliani did so, calling the department's acting deputy secretary, who said he lacked the authority to audit or impound the voting machines. Donald Trump pressed Rudolph Giuliani to make that inquiry after rejecting a separate effort by his outside advisors to have the Pentagon take control of the machines. And the outreach to the Department of Homeland Security came not long after Donald Trump, in an Oval Office meeting with Attorney General William Barr, raised the possibility of whether the Justice Department could seize the voting machines, a previously undisclosed suggestion that William Barr immediately shot down. The new accounts show that Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in exploring proposals to use his national security agencies to seize voting machines, as he grasped unsuccessfully for evidence of fraud that would help him reverse his defeat in the 2020 presidential election, according to people familiar with the episodes. The existence of proposals to use at least three federal departments to assist Donald Trump's attempt to stay in power has been publicly known. The proposals involving the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security were codified by advisers in the form of draft executive orders. But the new accounts provide fresh insight into how the former president considered and to some degree pushed the plans, which would have taken the United States into uncharted territory by using federal authority to seize control of the voting systems run by states on baseless grounds of widespread voting fraud. The people familiar with the matter were briefed on the events by participants or had first-hand knowledge of them. The accounts about the voting machines emerged after a weekend when Donald Trump declared at a rally in Texas that he might pardon people charged in connection with the storming of the Capitol last 6th of January if he were re-elected. In a statement issued after the rally, Donald Trump also suggested that his vice president, Mike Pence, could have personally overturned the election by refusing to count delegates to the Electoral College who had vowed to cast their votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. The new information helps to flesh out how the draft executive orders to seize voting machines came into existence and points in particular to the key role played by a retired Army colonel named Phil Waldron. According to people familiar with the accounts, Phil Waldron, shortly after the election, began telling associates that he had found irregularities in vote results that he felt were suggestive of fraud. He then came up with the idea of having a federal agency like the military or the Department of Homeland Security confiscate the voting machines to preserve evidence. Phil Waldron first proposed the notion of the Pentagon's involvement to Donald Trump's former national security advisor Michael Flynn, whom he says he served with in the Defense Intelligence Agency. The plans were among an array of options that were placed before Donald Trump in the tumultuous days and weeks that followed the election. Developed by an ad hoc group of lawyers like Sidney Powell and other allies including Michael Flynn and Phil Waldron. The group often found itself at odds with Rudy Giuliani and his longtime associate Bernard Kerik, as well as with Donald Trump's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his team. Around the same time that Donald Trump brought up the possibility of having the Justice Department seize the voting machines, for example, he also tried to persuade state lawmakers in contested states like Michigan and Pennsylvania to use local law enforcement agencies to take control of them, people familiar with the matter have confirmed. The state lawmakers refused to go along with the plan. The meeting with William Barr took place in mid to late November, when Donald Trump raised the idea of whether the Justice Department could be used to seize voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. Donald Trump told William Barr that his lawyers had told him that the department had the power to seize voting machines as evidence of fraud. Donald Trump mentioned a specific state that had used machines built by Dominion Voting Systems, where his lawyers believed there had been fraud, although it is unclear which state Donald Trump was referring to. William Barr, who had been briefed extensively at that point by federal law enforcement officials about how the theories being pushed by Donald Trump's legal team about the Dominion voting machines were unfounded, told Trump that the Justice Department had no basis for seizing the voting machines because there was no probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. It was only after several early options were exhausted that Phil Waldron pitched the idea of using other parts of the federal government to seize the machines to both Rudolph Giuliani and members of the Trump legal team, and also to Michael Flynn and his own associates, including Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne, a wealthy business executive who funded many of the efforts to challenge the election. Phil Waldron, who owns a bar and distillery outside Austin, Texas, was previously best known for having circulated a 38-page PowerPoint presentation to lawmakers and White House aides that was filled with extreme plans to overturn the election. Rudolph Giuliani was vehemently opposed to the idea of the military taking part in the seizure of voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. The conflict between him and his legal team and Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne came to a dramatic head on 18th of December 2020 during a meeting with Donald Trump in the Oval Office at the White House. At that meeting, Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell presented Donald Trump with a copy of the draft executive order authorizing the military to oversee the seizure of machines. After reading it, Donald Trump summoned Rudolph Giuliani to the Oval Office, according to one person familiar with the matter. When Rudy Giuliani read the draft order, he told Donald Trump that the military could be used only if there was clear-cut evidence of foreign interference in the U.S. presidential election. Sidney Powell, who had spent the past month filing lawsuits claiming that China and other countries had hacked into voting machines, said she had such evidence, the person said. But Rudy Giuliani was adamant that the military should not be mobilized, the person said, and Donald Trump ultimately heeded his advice. Shortly after the Oval Office meeting, Phil Waldron amended the draft executive order suggesting that if the U.S. Defense Department could not oversee the seizure of machines, then the Department of Homeland Security could, the person said. Around that time, Donald Trump asked Rudy Giuliani to call Kenneth Cusinelli, the acting deputy secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, to ask about the viability of the proposal, according to two people familiar with the matter. Kenneth Cusinelli said that Homeland Security officials could not take part in the plan. All of this was playing out amid open acrimony among White House aides and outside advisers about how best and how far to proceed with efforts to pursue Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud in the election. That same month, during a meeting on another matter, Donald Trump asked Kenneth Cusinelli what he thought of appointing a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Mr. Cusinelli, according to two people briefed on the conversation, said it was not a good idea for a variety of reasons. When Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne arrived at the White House to discuss their plan to use the military to seize voting machines, they were not let into the Oval Office by a typical gatekeeper like Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff. Rather, they were escorted in by Garrett Ziegler, a young aide to another Trump advisor, Peter Navarro, according to Mr. Ziegler's account. I waved in General Flynn and Sidney Powell on the Friday night of the 18th, for which Mark Meadows' office revoked my guest privileges, Mr. Ziegler said on a podcast, adding that he had done so because he was frustrated with the current counsel that Donald Trump was getting. Even Rudy Giuliani, who had spent weeks peddling some of the most outrageous claims about election fraud, felt that the idea of bringing in the military was beyond the pale. After Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell left the Oval Office, according to a person familiar with the matter, Rudy Giuliani predicted that the plans they were proposing were going to get Donald Trump impeached.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid. And not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time, but the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit. As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by a British royal family for centuries.
When William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness, they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network, calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized the slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed the slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century, after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution. Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that have used Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest Indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit Nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value in that it would show that the Church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against the First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the Church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control Indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the Indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate Indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the Church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The Church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the Church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the Church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words? Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds,
The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
IRIB English Radio.